Oh man. You know, sometimes I honestly wonder if the range of things that I'm curious about serves anybody well. This is a really gracious community, and I'm so grateful to be part of the community of the table. It is, in my experience, a community that is full of people that are also willing to probe a wide range of things, willing to go exploring together. Can't even begin to tell you all how grateful I am for that. That said, I kind of need to acknowledge as we get underway this morning that when I started to dig into what I wanted to explore today, I felt like I was wading in, to the ocean, and I took two steps and I was already over my head and swimming. And then I started reading academic papers on the topic, and it was like the bottom just dropped out. Not in a bad way necessarily, but in a way that could feel a little bit overwhelming, a little bit like, oh my goodness. I'll say a bit more about all of that as we go. But for now, the point is this is a big topic. This exploration launches us into a big, big topic. So a lot of my prep this week has been spent just trying to figure out how to kind of rein this one in, not to make it small and, kind of palatable so much, as how to focus this thing so that we don't all walk away at the end kind of shaking our heads and wondering what just happened. At the same time, as is fairly typical of the table, I don't feel at all reluctant about leaving us with more questions than answers. I would just like them to be, questions we can actually sort of define and work with. So that's all pretty vague. So let me see if telling a story can help. So what happened was I was already thinking about our ongoing exploration of matters pertaining to the divisive cultural climate that we're living in, and about seeking the common good, about trying to center themes that can help us all examine ways in which the things we believe might contribute to us being part of a healing conversation rather than alienating conversations. So all of that good stuff that we've already been exploring. And then, as part of another project that I was working on, someone pointed me toward a really inspiring person here in Winnipeg named Jimmy Thunder. If you don't know who this is, and I didn't, you could just ask Uncle Google to show you something called Reconciliation Thunder on either Facebook or YouTube, and in particular, Jimmy's series called Dear Younger Me, which sort of starts with a bit of a contemporary poem in the first piece, kind of a spoken word piece might be a better way to define it, and then goes on to unpack that piece over a series of short YouTube or Facebook vignettes. It's a gracious, succinct primer on things pertaining to reconciliation and decolonization, which, by the way, is sort of the big topic terrain we're entering, and I would say well worth watching. So that happened. And then in the middle of all of that, the drama that is called politics to the south of us had a big week. Don't know if you noticed there was this inauguration thing. And I'm not a fan of that kind of milieu in general, but I'm also not so naive as to think that ignoring it's going to make it go away. And so I thought I should at least, check in. And so I did that. And when I did, I encountered a couple of things that continued to stir this all. I encountered an inauguration address that was, in many respects, on about the same sorts of themes we've been exploring, in particular, the theme of unity. I will remain intrigued to see how Joe Biden's Catholicism, his Catholic Christian beliefs, about which he is quite overt, inform his politics and his relationships. I'm interested to see how that plays out, but he's certainly not sidelining it. And so his ideas about unity are discernibly informed by those sorts of themes. So I encountered that, and that was interesting. I also encountered, in fact, I was blown away by, I was moved to tears by the US Youth Poet Laureate Amanda Gorman's recitation of her poem, The Hill We Climb, which came at me not with the rhythms of the classics or feeling like a product of the university literature department so much as a product of the rhymes of the street. And it included phrases like these. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice. And then later in the piece, Gorman said, "We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another." Wow. I was fascinated by her also commenting that, you know, in a way that was obviously personal, that it was interesting that a young black woman could dream of one day being the president and end up reciting for him. At another point, Gorman references a text from the First Testament part of the Bible, from the Old Testament, where she talks about this dream of everybody having their own place of enough food, enough shelter, enough safety. That text shows up in a bunch of different places in the Old Testament, but in particular in the words that she's using, it shows up in a text in the minor prophet Micah, and where that author talks about everybody having their own vine and fig tree. And that's a powerful idea in any context. And the Micah text also talks about them being able to enjoy that without fear. And yeah, that's a powerful idea. That's a powerful idea anywhere, anytime. In the context in which it was written, as far as we can tell, it was written about the poor people of the land being able to once again enjoy the simple but essential goodness of those basic things. They were things which had been taken from them as part of the growing divide in the land between the rich and the poor. To hear a young black woman in the setting of the inauguration of a white U.S. president speak with so much wisdom and clarity and passion and poise and hope kind of rocked my world. And then, while all of that was swirling around inside of me, I was continuing to dig into the idea that many of the systems that have caused and continue to cause so much suffering and division in the world have their roots in European religious history, and in particular, in the history of Christianity. Now that is distressing enough to me. I'm a white man, and my own history is all tangled up with that Christian story, never mind the European Christian story. But it is made all the more potent by the easily discernible fact that those systems are not just history. They are still too often what just is, but not justice. They are woven into contemporary legal systems and precedents and decisions, rulings. They are part of the unspoken assumptions about the nature of religion itself, which is another huge issue. And we've seen that. We've seen that over and over again right here in our own city. When religious organizations demand exceptional treatment because of their belief that their version of what God says isn't subject to the laws of the land, they are squarely in this terrain. There's a verticality to that whole set of assumptions that says what we believe is sanctioned by God in a way that what you believe is not. So we should get to do We should get to behave in the world the way we want to behave in the world, regardless of what's already been agreed upon by the peoples living in a place. How all of this might feel to someone whose people, someone who themselves has been marginalized, abused, or silenced by those same systems, that's a hard thing for me to know or understand. I can't enter into it, partly because, as we'll touch on in a moment, I'm so embedded in the systems that are part of the problem. And that led me to some aspects of the current conversation on undoing what is commonly called the doctrine of discovery. Now, That's a conversation that repeatedly references the ways in which an idea can be immoral or come to be understood as immoral when once it was not understood that way. And in being worked out in cultures and business and policies and being worked out on people's bodies, those kinds of ideas can do untold harm to everything from big ideas like freedom or justice to individual experiences of every kind. So there I was, you know, swimming above that point where you're snorkeling along above the reef, and all of a sudden the reef ends and whoop, and it's just bottomless blue. And I was wondering what to do with this on a Sunday morning. What might I do that might not end up being trite or simplistic or disingenuous or obfuscating, which is sort of a classic way to deal with these things, just make them so ridiculously complicated that everybody walks away from the conversation, or just plain hurtful. So I ended up in the middle of all of this thinking about a conversation that I had had the week before with my buddy Steve Bell. We were having a Zoom chat about how many of the ancient spiritual practices that have endured were born in times of suffering. They weren't born in times of luxury or kind of detached reflection. They came out of things like epidemics and pandemics. And it's intriguing to me how the practices that have those kind of origins don't tend to solve anything. They, in many ways, they seem a bit incomprehensible to our modern outcome-oriented sensibilities because they often invite us to just be still and peer into mystery. Instead of charging out the door all fired up about the right thing to do, as though there could only be one such, you know, right thing. In some ways, they function like all symbols do. They function as signposts that point to something, but are not the thing itself. And that's sort of a key idea in our exploration this morning, that many of the things that we latch onto as though they were solid are symbols. They point to something, but they're not the thing itself. And you can think about it this way. If I take the letters F-I-S-H, and I say them to you, assuming you know how to spell in the English language, you would be able to recognize that I just spelled fish. It almost seems silly to say it, but you would also probably understand that the word is not the thing itself. The word fish isn't a fish. In fact, if I were to ask you what those letters mean, you might say they mean fish, but what you mean by fish and what I mean by fish would not be the same thing. That word, fish, means something really different to a kid that just got a goldfish in a bowl than it does to a marine biologist, than it does to somebody who has a deadly fish allergy. The word is a symbol. It points to not just something, but to a wider category of ideas about something. So when I say fish, it would be short-sighted of me to assume that you and I mean or picture the same thing, right? Now, that could all sound a little pedantic and obvious. Problem is, we don't tend to plug it into things that we cherish, right? Or things that we're super accustomed to. So one of the implications of that, though, is that at the very least, that should inform the way that I use the word fish, or any word. It should add some underlying humility to its use, some curiosity about what you might mean by that word, or what that word might mean to somebody other than me. Because the only way for me to more fully imagine what that word might point toward is to ask you what it means to you, and then to add to my own storehouse of imagined meanings by hearing about yours. And that means not starting with the assumption that what I mean by fish is the right meaning, the one that actually means the thing itself. Which in an interesting way brings us to things like decolonization and the doctrine of discovery. Water's getting deeper. Let's just start with decolonization. Now, let me just say, at the risk of repeating myself, that in some ways, this is where we swim over the edge of the reef, right? This is where we get out into depths that are too far to ever fully plumb. Nobody can. It's not just that we can't. Nobody can. And yet, at the same time, we are still in the same ocean We're still in the same watery sort of milieu that we're in if we're just waiting along the shoreline to cool our feet a little bit. So these things are connected, and yet they have these different sort of aspects or features or experiences. So in other words, exploring something like decolonization is something that can take us into both great big ideas, but also into the most sort of ordinary, everyday things that are about our common actions, our common speech, our common assumptions. And both are essential to contributing to making a better world, a world where, as the prophet Micah wrote, everyone can meaningfully dream of sitting under their own vine and fig tree, of having what they need and being able to enjoy it without fear. Right? That world. Very short version. Decolonization is about change. It's about changing the way that we think and talk and act through a radical engagement with a plurality of voices and perspectives that have been historically marginalized and silenced. It's about changes that both are taking place and changes that should be taking place. And here's an idea that struck me as quite interesting. Decolonization is not the same as diversifying. And this is important because I think diversifying and diversity is one of the ways in which many organizations have sort of approached this, and maybe many of us as individuals as well, and it kind of allows us to give ourselves a nice little pat on the back, but it doesn't really get into the terrain that we need to be in. Let me see if I can unpack that a little bit. The aim of diversity is to accommodate. It's to make space for alternatives. It's to make space for differences. Think about this for a moment. If we're making space for an alternative or a difference, where are we making that space? We are making it within an established system. Otherwise, the metaphor doesn't make any sense. You don't make space in a void. You make it inside something, right? And so you already have a defined something when you're dealing with diversity in which you are going to make space. You're going to make room for an alternative viewpoint or a different way of thinking about things. But the existing scheme or structure within which you're making space is going to remain largely unchanged. It's going to be the authoritative voice that is saying, we're going to make space here, in this part. We're going to adjust this. We're going to accommodate that, right? So the structure is still kind of the authoritative, the buck stops here voice. I realize this might be a touchy illustration. I couldn't think of one that wouldn't be. So I thought I'd pick one that could be close to home for me. So a way to illustrate this difference might be to think about this imaginary scenario where we've got straight parents, we've got a heteronormative, if you will, relationship. And this relationship, there's some children, and one of the children comes to the parents and says, Mom, Dad, I'm queer. I'm coming out to you. I'm not straight. And the parents, who are good people, they're loving people, they say to their kid, honey, we love you no matter what. Now, that might be super well-intentioned response. And it might also be a way of saying, we love you and we will make room for you and your differences from us, your differences from your departure from our system of understanding big things like gender and sexuality, but we're not going to consider changing our system. We love you no matter what. We accommodate this difference. Now, is that better than you're shunned, get out of the house? Well, yeah, of course it is. Does it actually change the things or even truly address itself to changing the systems that made coming out feel hazardous to that person in the first place? No, it does not. It leaves those things solidly, dominantly in place. That's the difference between diversity and decolonization. So, diversity is an important idea, and it can help us move along the track toward dreams like a just or an equitable society. But it's probably not going to move us very far. Because as soon as the strain of diversity puts an uncomfortable amount of pressure on the existing structures or on those that hold positional power or wealth as power in those structures, there's going to be a collision. And the structure and those within the structure who benefit by it are not going to be inclined to move further. Someone I was reading this week said that decolonization is not about finding space at the table. It's about changing the room. Yeah. This is of that magnitude. This is why the water, I think, felt like it got so deep for me when I swam into these ideas, because as I studied with more diligence and more kind of investment, I started to realize in a fresh way, although my cognition had touched on the magnitude of this, but I didn't feel like it had made it down into my gut at all in the way that it did this week. This is huge. Now, as always at the table, you know, one of the things that I think is important for exploring what we believe is that we don't have to agree. So I'm going to say these things in the way that I am becoming convinced about them, but not because I am trying to argue that I have some sort of thin red line to some higher authority who's telling me this is the only way to understand this. I'm exploring too. My exploration, though, brought me to this feeling, this sense, as well as this cognitive appreciation that we need to locate ourselves inside of these problematic systems before we can be meaningfully involved in the kind of changes that actually address themselves to these huge, sprawling, embedded, interleaved things that cause so much harm. And if I was going to choose an entry point for this community, not for everybody in it, obviously, but maybe more than not, which is what I usually kind of aim at, if I was going to try to choose an entry point into the next layer of this, the layer in which we try to locate ourselves inside the systems that are problems, I would choose the conversation that's going on these days around the dismantling of the doctrine of discovery. To me, this feels like now I can't even, if I look back over my shoulder, I can't even see the reef anymore. It's just everywhere I look, there's deep water. In today's particular talky bit, in the context of the table, when I kind of got to this point in unfolding this stuff, I was like, you know what? That's where I need to go. That's what I need to explore here. And that's what I need to kind of lay out on the table for us to look at together. And then I started to write that and what that would look like to do that. And I realized there's no way I could fit it into this talky bit. It's just, yeah, it wouldn't have worked. I would have had to like just reduce something to something enormous and important into like a soundbite. And there's enough of that going on in the world. I didn't want to do that here. So we're going to pick that up next week. But I do want to wrap up the exploration that we've already done. So to wrap that up, what I want to do is circle back to the fish and the shady fig tree. When I say fish, it means something different to me than to you. The same thing is true when I say God or creator or divine or any other word that we've made up that points beyond ourselves to the kinds of mysteries we make up those kinds of terms for. When we start with the assumption that what we mean by a term or a story is the only right way to understand that term or story, including our stories about that for which we would use God language, we not only get ourselves into trouble by reducing the possibilities, by squelching the mystery, we are already, if we start with that kind of an assumption, we are already on the path to insisting that other people take up the same meaning or be judged by those who hold it. And that, if we exercise it with vertical power, puts us on the path to being oppressors. That's a pretty harsh thing to say. But I think when we get into this disassembling of the doctrine of discovery and its intertwinedness with some parts of religious history, we're going to see that that's actually how this works. Worked and works. Both. If we want it in very general historic terms, this belief and practice that the way I define things like God is that my understanding of that is the right one, that belief and the doctrines, the ideas, the agreed upon ideas that came out of it in European religious and cultural history are the very things that imbued those that got on a ship in France, and we'll unpack this next week, and sailed over the edge of the horizon into the deep, carrying this idea that they were given the authority to do what they were doing by their beliefs about God and governance and land. That they believed that in such a way that when they arrived on a continent where there was already a people group with beliefs about that which they could not see or understand fully, God by European, in European language, and already had culture around that, already had practices for engaging with and honoring and living in obedient response and engagement and intertwinedness with that mystery. They already had all those things. And then these folks arrived and they stuck a, you know, flag on the beach and said, by the authority of, and then, you know, sort of these from God and country, which means our understanding of those things, this is our land. And the laws are now need to be ours. And so on and so forth. See how this stuff connects? Anyway, we'll get into it more. But that's how we get what we use a word like colonization. There you go. That's as tidy as I know how to make it at the moment. And in particular, what I just described is the version of colonization that we've experienced among other places on this continent. And if I had stopped for our land acknowledgement, I would have been naming agreements made under that exact profound misapprehension of the limits of our human understanding. And this is why a savvy poet like Amanda Gorman can meaningfully reference an almost 3,000-year-old text like Micah 4:4 in the process of trying to stir a nation's imagination about how a just world might come to be moving forward into 2021. Amanda Gorman is a poet. She works with words all the time. She knows that they are as slippery as fish. And she also knows that when we will let them swim in their own water, they will shimmer and intrigue and fascinate. And if we just lean into them, they will help us all to ponder what it might be like to be other than we are. To imagine not only our own place of shade and plenty and safety, but also to ask you how you might imagine yours and how we can work together so we can both enjoy such a place. That's where I'm going to leave it this morning.